Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yes, indeed. And this is episode number 112. And we are going to talk about Herman Wouk's The Caine Mutiny, a novel of World War II, it says, on my copy. But it's not really, is it? Although it takes place in World War II, it's kind of universal.
I was surprised to see that it was really more the story of a young man growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Or maturing, I guess you would say.
Right. And the young man is Willie Keith.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe Herman Wouk. This book was published in 1951, and it won a Pulitzer Prize.
Not that long after World War II ended then.
That's right. And Herman Wouk, by the way, is still alive. He was born in 1915. According to Wikipedia, he's 100 years old.
Wow.
And, So he, it says he joined the United States Navy and served in the Pacific Theater during World War II, an experience he later characterized as educational, of course. I learned about machinery, I learned about how men behave under pressure, and I learned about Americans, he said. And he served as an officer aboard two destroyers minesweepers. I'm reading it, it's DMS, it says for short. The USS Zane and the USS Southard.
Okay.
Becoming executive officer of the latter. And he started to write a novel, Aurora Dawn, during off-duty hours aboard ship. Wouk sent a copy of the opening chapters to Erwin Edmund, who quoted a few pages verbatim to a New York editor. And the result was a publisher's contract sent to Wouk's ship, which was then off the coast of Okinawa.
Wow.
Yeah, so I read that paragraph, and there's a lot of that paragraph in this novel.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, Willie Keith is, well...
No, Kiefer.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, Kiefer, well, but... Yeah, it's interesting. Well, we'll get more into Kiefer and stuff. You know, I guess there's autobiographical parts.
Well, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe none of the characters are specifically him.
I know the foreword to mine just says it's a work of fiction, and he's, you know, compressed some things and distorted some things, and also, you know, of course, made some things up.
Yeah.
And, he said that, like, the character of the captain was from a study of different case histories and isn't real and that kind of thing. Although I know that the Kurt Jester, Jeff Miller, mm-hmm. made a comment, wasn't it in one of the comments boxes after we said we were going to read it? Or maybe it was in Goodreads. I can't remember, where he said they had a captain that he looked back, because he was in the Navy, and he mm-hmm. said they had a captain who... After reading this book, he looked back and went, oh, yeah, he was kind of incompetent, but we kind of contributed in the same way that happens in this book. And so I thought that was kind of an interesting comment.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Although I think a lot of the things that we'll talk about later in terms of that sort of thing where you have somebody who's maybe not very well liked or is a bit shady... or a bit incompetent, that happens in any closed system like a company, where departments will turn on people and that kind of thing too. It's just not as isolated as important a lot of the time as a military captain in the Navy during the war.
Yeah, and I agree. You know, I've throughout my career have, I've never been in the military, but I feel that I've been in some stressful situations at work. Current job and previous jobs. So. And I think that's a very interesting position. I guess, you know, you can see people differently when that happens.
Right.
And I think a lot of that was in this book.
It occurs to me, and I realize this is out of context for anybody who hasn't read it, but... this entire book could be considered a warning about gossip. And I know, but when I think about the damage that it does in a lot of the cases and the way people take it seriously or apply what they hear through gossip, and, you know, Pope Francis's death on that, not that anybody's pro it, but he speaks about it a lot and talks about how it's a killer. It kills reputations, it kills people's good names. Well, I guess that's a reputation, but, you know, it's bad. It's equivalent to killing. So
that's very interesting.
Yeah.
I don't think that I really thought much about the gossip in this book. Maybe, you know, I thought more about, you know, the actions of everybody, which were true.
Oh, I felt like, well, we could talk about this later.
Let's do. Yeah. So let's put it in context. So, first of all, a quick summary. like you said, the book is about this young man, Willie Keith, who at the opening of the book is just entering training as an officer. Well, he's going in for his, you know, physical and that stuff. And I don't know. I feel like I want to kind of summarize it in a short manner so that we can get into the good stuff. So all it is, it's about his career. Well, it's about him, you know, more than his career. You know, there's his family life and his hopeful love life is involved as well. But he gets assigned to a minesweeping ship called the USS Kane, C-A-I-N-E, and it's very disappointing to him. Not only because, you know, he felt that, you know, all the good stuff was happening on the carriers and the and the destroyers, right? He didn't, you know, want to be on a minesweeper, which part of its duties was to, you know, basically just drive in a grid while dragging something that would destroy a mine if it hit it. If I understand right.
Yeah.
And then some of the other things that it would do is it would have to drag a target so that the rest of the fleet could have target practice.
Right.
So that's the kind of duty that he pulled. And not only that, but it was really old and wasn't a very neat ship. And the sailors were lax.
Yeah.
These are all things that he found disappointing when he first got on there.
Well, and also, since he comes from a very wealthy background and he's never had to be responsible for anything or do anything, he doesn't know how to judge the people around him very well, because he's never really been in that kind of environment either. So that's also factored in.
Right. So he has certain expectations that were dashed.
Yeah.
And his captain at that time was Captain DeVry? DeVries?
Yeah.
I think it's DeVry. And he has interactions with his captain that are not very pleasant. He doesn't have a lot of respect for the captain pretty much from the moment they meet. You know, he's like, you know, just wearing underwear, if I remember right, sitting at his desk. And, you know, it says, what are your orders and things? And, you know, it's like, what, are you not impressed?
Yeah, you're right.
That kind of stuff.
It's not ship shape.
It's not ship shape, this place. So again, just to get through a quick summary, he starts to function under this captain and is not enjoying himself. He feels that certain things are being ignored and certain things are being emphasized that are different than he would do, and he's pretty much disgusted the whole time.
Well, and he's not taking it very seriously most of the time either. Mm-hmm. Like, because he'll get some urgent message and he'll forget and stick it in his pocket.
Right. That was a big event.
Yeah. I mean, so he himself is not taking it seriously. In a way, I mean, I guess that reflects what he thinks of everything, but also just his youth and inexperience as a person, too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I definitely want to come back to that event to talk about that more. So what happens very soon is that orders come through that a new captain is coming to the Kane. And this captain is Lieutenant Commander, I think it's Philip Queeg.
Ah.
Philip something Queeg. Yeah, Q-U-E-E-G. And he is a captain who initially this ensign thinks is refreshing, you know, a breath of fresh air. This is what the Navy is. This is, you know, this is going to be much better.
He's by the book.
He's by the book. Yeah, and his first speech that when he sits down with his officers, he just says, hey, if you do everything by the book, you're gonna get along with me just fine. But then as time goes on, and this is like a 500-page novel, so there's a lot of events.
Yeah.
But as time goes on, the captain proves himself to be much different than originally judged by the ensign, Willie Keith. Yeah. And I'm just trying to think of how to quickly summarize this so we can get in a little deeper. But him and his fellow executive officers, or I guess there's only one executive officer, him and his fellow officers basically have to live under this leader, and they all start to have their own opinions of him. And then eventually things come to a head and the title of the book becomes important.
Yeah, there is a mutiny.
Yeah. And then about the last, I would say, 80 pages of the book or so are the trial, the court-martial of the officers who did the deed.
And
so that's a quick summary.
Well, I would say the other thing is there's a parallel thread going through all this because we meet Willie Keith before he signs up. And it's that he was a piano player and a kind of a songwriter, and he meets this girl who he's very attracted to, and she is, this shows the age of the book, which I find also very interesting. For one thing, she's ethnic, Italian. Mm-hmm. So,
oh no.
It's like, oh, she's Italian. Oh, okay, fine. And also Catholic. Yeah, that is, it can rub off, but it probably will come back. It gets said later in the book. Anyway, they're very attracted to each other, but Willie keeps finding himself kind of at the mercy of his emotions, where he'll go, marry me. And then he'll finally talk her into it because she's like, you're super rich. I'm not going to do it. And he'll talk her into it. She'll go, well, okay. And then he'll go, oh, how fast can I get rid of her? That was the biggest mistake ever. And so, that it's funny because that tension is going on the whole way through the book before he signs up, when he's in training, when he's got leave, and later at the end. So these two threads are showing him maturing. And I guess that's it, mainly. I was thinking there was another dimension.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think it shows a lot of his maturity throughout the book, where he's like, yes, yes, yes. No. Mm-hmm. And then yes. You know, and his reasons for all of it are laid completely out.
Yeah.
So it did make for a really interesting reading. And, you know, he would write letters to her. But, yeah, that was interesting, too.
Yeah.
And then another big aspect that I certainly want to talk about is the influence of his father.
Yes.
And his mother. Mm-hmm. So his mother survives throughout the book, but his dad dies very early in the book.
Right.
I guess that was too spoilerific, maybe.
Yeah, but, it's pretty much into that. And it's
And he was a large influence on his son. So,
which is kind of funny because he was kind of a non-entity in the home. The mother's got a big personality and runs things. And so that makes, when the father does speak up, it suddenly gets heard much more loudly than usual.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, so, and he kind of resonates throughout the book.
Yeah.
So, yeah, good summary.
I think so too. So, yeah, so that's the summary. Is there anything you'd like to add to the summary before
My comment about Keith and May, or Willie and May, was the one thing, because I found that the most interesting part of the book until you got about...
Not the vowels? What about the vowels? I mentioned,
engineer's
vowels,
book.
I don't like the vowels. Yeah, there were times where it was describing, you know, operations and how you need to point the ship in this direction to survive, okay. High of seas and stuff.
Can admit to a certain amount of skimming when the battle scenes were going on. Okay, a lot of ass skimming.
And I'm reading those like super close. I'm like,
I kind of be looking for what is everybody doing, because I'm just like, I don't really care, and I know that is important. But the thing that did strike me about this is it's a good novel. I like it. I'm glad we read it. But cool. I have two other books, seafaring books, that I have read from when I was young. And my favorite is The Sand Pebbles. And it's funny how, you're talking about, and then there were the valves, and then there were the battle scenes. And in that one, though, in The Sand Pebbles, I devoured every aspect of it because it was so important personally to, I think Jake is his name, the main character. And I was like, wow, it's interesting that you can see that's not that important to these characters because I don't have to know it here.
Hmm. So what is the Sea Pebbles about?
Oh, the Sand Pebbles is about...
Uh-huh. Sand Pebbles, right.
It is really... I think you'd like it, but it's about one of these... U.S., I guess it's a steamship, but back before the Boxer Rebellion in China, when the country was kind of divided up among all the different European powers, and the American military had these, I think they were steamships, but there were some kind of a, military warships that would go up and down the Yangtze River, the Yellow River. Mm-hmm. And this guy, Jake, is an engineer on one of them. And he comes on, and they're all like, we got coolies to do all that. But they're treated like second-class citizens. Well, they are second-class citizens. So it's about him and how he never really fits into the Navy, but he fits in this culture, in this warship culture, in this lax environment, and his relationship with one of the coolies who he takes under his wing, and just the whole political thing that's going on, but through the lens of that ship. It's really a great book.
Wonderful. Okay.
Just FYI.
And yeah, and you mentioned that there were two.
Oh, what's, the other
the is, other one when the Eli.
Yeah, the other one is no. I loved also The Mutiny on the Bounty.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that's,
I've never read that.
Yeah, and there's actually a trilogy by Nordoff and Hall, and it's The Mutiny on the Bounty. Oh gosh, I can't remember the name. The last one's Pitcairn's Island, and I can't remember the name of the second. But the first is about the ship going to, might be the Sandwich Islands or the Cook Islands. Anyway, they're going to go get breadfruit fruit trees. And it's told from the point of view of a young sailor who it's his first ship out. And he's learning the ropes. And it's been made into several movies, Christian Fletcher and Captain Bly. And it's all based on something that really happened, though. Mm. And so a mutiny happens and it's a lot more up in the air to where you could go either way, I think, on how you feel about it. The second one is a fascinating book. It's about what happens to the people who are put over the side with the captain in this little dinghy. Like, here, we won't kill you. Here we are out in the middle of the ocean. Here's some stuff. Good luck. Wow. And then the third one is about the mutineers who go back and then say they're going to come after us. If anybody makes it, they're coming back after us. So they go off and find their own island to live on with their native women that they take with them, and it's their story.
Interesting.
Yes, okay. Great trilogy. So,
very cool. I was trying, as you were talking, I was reminded of, there's a series of books about the something seafaring. I can't remember. Actually, no, I'm sorry. I brought it up because... I don't know. It was a whole series of novels. I was wondering if you'd read any.
Oh, the Master and Commander.
Yeah, that's O'Brien. It. Right.
Yeah, I tried.
Patrick O'Brien.
Yeah, I tried the first one. I just didn't care about it.
Okay, I was just curious.
Yeah, I liked the movie with Russell Crowe and. I
haven't seen that.
Oh.
We're worth watching, huh?
Oh yeah, it was really a good movie, and of course, the guy who plays the ship's doctor, who's the captain's friend, is the actor I really love, and I can't remember his name. But anyway, it's a good movie.
Cool.
But I know a lot of people just love the series.
Yeah.
I just didn't care about it.
Okay. Sounds good. All right. Back to the Caine Mutiny.
Yeah.
So I really like this book. I read it several years ago,
okay.
So I picked it again. Because, I really did enjoy it. So
no, it was
I'm glad
good.
We read it.
I'm glad,
I'm
we,
glad
yeah.
you have read it again.
Yeah, I'm glad we read it.
Right. So, okay. So we're going to get into some deeper stuff now. So if you want to stop here and read it, please feel free. Otherwise, I'm going to delve a little.
Ooh.
Let's delve.
Okay.
Let's delve.
Go for it.
So, yeah, one of the first things that I marked was this letter from his dad.
Oh, yeah.
So what occurs is, you know, Willie Keith, his dad is walking with a limp during the first part of the novel, and he's not telling his son that he actually has a major health issue. And that was interesting in light of our Siskel and Ebert talk last week. So I just thought of it in that light, and I was like, wow. You know, that would be tough to all of a sudden find out that, yeah, I've been keeping this from you, but because you're gone to sea now with the Navy, I will probably never see you again. And
yeah.
Just thinking, oh, my goodness gracious.
But I think that because of he knew this was Willie Keith's only chance to get out from under his mother's thumb, really.
Yeah.
And I really feel
and
like...
And he explains that in the letter. I thought that the letter... You have to read in between the lines a little bit, but some of the stuff that he said to his son, like, for example, you know, he's speaking to Willie. It seems to me you're very much like our whole country. Young, naive, spoiled, and softened by abundance and good luck, but with an interior hardness that comes from your sound stock. So it's interesting that he's like, okay, you are blessed with abundance and good luck.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our whole country is, because of this, it is young, naive, and spoiled and softened by abundance and good luck.
Yeah.
That's an interesting concept for me, softened by abundance and good luck, because I think that that's very often true.
Oh, yeah. And
yeah, it's
you know, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I mean, we're here in this country, you know, and we're enjoying a lot of amazing things, and you know, a lot of the world isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, do you? I guess your response to that, you know, they say, I've heard a number of times that, you know, it's you know, we talk about suffering. We've talked about suffering here.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Quite a bit.
We are Catholic,
and what,
so yeah.
Right? And what comes out of suffering? And, you know, what happens if you don't have any of that? You know, what's a person's reason for, you know, seeking God and seeking religion and thinking these thoughts if the person is just, you know, flushed with abundance all the time?
Well, and even if you are, you can be looking for God anyway, because, I mean, I didn't have any particular hardship that drove me to God, you know.
And nor did I.
Right.
Nor did I.
But I think it kind of goes back to Jesus saying, you know, it's going to be the narrow road, right? Not the wide gate. And he's like, you know, boy, very few rich people are going to get to go to heaven. And his disciples are like, what? That's not what we learned. And he's like, I'm just saying, and I think we've seen that in our own lives, possibly. I have, especially lately, is you don't want those hard times, but when you're struggling through them, you come out the other end and you've either learned something, or you're a little tougher than you were, or something good comes of it somehow. And I can't remember if I've mentioned this before, but, you know, our business hasn't been doing very well, and it's just been awful. Mm-hmm. But the other day, we were putting away the dishes or something, and he was talking about, you know, business contacts he'd made and this meeting he was going to go to for networking and all this stuff. And I'd been talking about stuff I was doing, and I suddenly said, you know, this is all really gross to go through, but don't you feel like we've suddenly been woken up? And he just stopped and looked at me, and he said, kind of like a bucket of cold water. I said, yeah, I was thinking like a slap in the face, but it's like we're awake. We're more alive than we were.
Hmm.
And that is something that, you know, we're not out of the woods. We're still struggling, but there's a different attitude, and we're more actively, I don't know, alive. So
yeah, and that's I think that that's what the book is.
Mm-hmm.
Because these guys, you know, they're in the Navy, you know, and they're going through war, for heaven's sakes, and it's horrible. And in the face of this stress and suffering, they wake up, and their true selves are what emerges.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's to me what the most important piece of the book is.
Okay, because that goes along with the part that I was thinking. If I had to pick a huge theme to say that the book teaches or is about, mine was that we learn who we are through experiences and living life. It's how we find out what we're made of, and how we recover and learn from our mistakes determines a lot of our character, which is what they're going through. And that's what you're, I just had a different way of saying it. Maybe.
No, I think that is the same thing. Yeah. 'Cause it's really, you know, you're under pressure, which is what life is.
Yeah.
You know, we all, you know, and I, you know, my previous statement, I didn't mean to say that we don't have hardship.
Oh, no.
You know, I mean, it's like, you know, we have plenty of hardship. You know, most of us have things, we all have our own things.
But not in the way a lot of people do. We have it pretty easy in this country, you know.
Yeah, most of the people in this country are not worried about where they're going to eat next.
Yeah, I've heard, I haven't seen this, but I've heard that the poor people in our country would be considered rich in a lot of countries. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know for sure either. We're certainly at a different level.
Well, and it also kind of made me think that whole thing about experience and living life is, I was thinking, is that why we're here on Earth? I mean, from the Catholic point of view, when death happens, death is just the next step into another form of existence. Is this is our, you know, time at sea?
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah, and that's what Willie Keith, he actually says something. Willie ends up playing the piano for an admiral at Pearl Harbor, and he starts to feel guilty because he's like, okay, I'm in the war, I got this letter from my dad has these high hopes that the Navy is going to help me become the next level of me. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting here playing the piano for an admiral in Pearl Harbor. And he finally says, you know, because he's got orders, right? He's got orders. And he's like, okay, you know, and the guy says, you know, get used to it. It's going to be your home for a long, long time. It's time to, you know, he just showing him the ship. And he says, suits me, sir, said Willie. I'm due for some sea duty. He had resigned himself to a stay of 6 months to a year. It was his year in the wilderness, the ordeal of which his father had written, and he was ready to face it.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then later, he's fed up. Can't take it. Mm-hmm. Everything's getting to him. And his father had promised to send him a Bible, but he hadn't done it. He said, or it hadn't come with the letter. The letter got there at a different time. And the Bible shows up with a little note, and it's right when he's going to be picked up to go play the piano or something for some admiral, maybe the same admiral, and he knows he can finagle it into an easier duty. And in the Bible, it says, or in the note that comes with it, he says, well, my son, take a look at Ecclesiastes 9:10, will you? I'll let that stand as my last word to you. No more now, nothing more now, but goodbye and God bless you. Dad. Willie turned to the Bible passage with shaking hands. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might, for there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest. The words were underlined with wavering ink lines. Beside them, Dr. Keith had written in the broad margin, he's talking about your job on the cane, Willie. Good luck. Oh, okay. Nail in the coffin of that plan.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, and that's interesting. And, you know, when you think about the parable of the talents in the New Testament, you know, where God seems to be saying, okay, well, you have a certain set of things and you should use them,
mm-hmm.
you know, use that stuff. if you're not using it, you're probably not doing my will, right?
Yeah, and everybody may not be given the same number of talents, but the one who gets in trouble is the one who buries it in a field.
Exactly.
It's like, I was afraid I'd lose it, you know, and he's like, are you insane? You could have at least put it in the bank and gotten some interest. You know, you didn't even try a little. Even a little is better than that. That's a good point.
Yeah. That's good stuff. So anything else to say about his dad? I really thought that was just so powerful.
It was very powerful, and I thought it was really interesting that his father expresses regret, because his father says, wow, I'd really like to meet your girlfriend. He kind of knows there's a girlfriend, and or he gets it out of him. And because, you know, she's ethnic and poor, so she's been hidden from the family, basically. And he says, you know, there was a girl once before your mother. Well, no, I'm happy with what your mother and I, that's fine. She's a fine woman, you know, but you knew there were regrets. And at toward the end of the book or toward the middle of the book, his mother also, of course, she's trying to talk him out of marrying May, who she's now met, and says, oh, really? But she says she met somebody who she was in love with before she married Willie's father, and she also expressed regret, although it was less directed toward, gee, I wish I'd have done that, because she's trying to sway him away from it. But you got that feeling of lingering regret from both of them that goes along with this theme of, you know, live your life to the fullest and don't think about money or position as much as, are you doing something that makes you come alive, basically? And if this person is the person who does that, that's who you should pick.
Right. And he struggled against that. Yeah, that's interesting.
Every time he turns around, he'll be in the passion of the moment. He's like, yes, or, you know, he'll almost have died at sea, and he'll think, ah, here's one thing I know. I love May. And then he'll get close to her, and she'll go, okay. And he'll go, oh, I shouldn't do it. How can I get out of it?
Yeah, I mean, that's really something, you know, because the Navy was a very valuable experience for him, right? He was transformed by it completely.
Yeah,
in my opinion. But yet he was like part of a system. You know, so I'm trying, you know, I agree with what you said. I'm trying to reconcile his experience in this Navy, which was a growing, strengthening experience, with the idea that he should be doing what he loves. Which I agree with you is the end of it, you know, because once he's free, then he finally gets to do what he loves, and that's where the happiness is going to come in, you hope.
Well, and that's what the
he
father...
He lived happily ever after.
Yeah, the father tells him to do that, too.
Exactly. Exactly, he does. He says, you know, after this, you're going to get to do this stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, like when he's in the Navy, I thought it was really something, you know, there's this guy, Kiefer.
Yeah.
And Kiefer, he's presented as a, you know, really smart guy. He's lackadaisical, though, and he's writing a novel. And it seems like, you know, he's kind of detached. What he's on the planet to write this novel, and the Navy is kind of in his way. But he's in the Navy. That's kind of how I got him. And he was always saying things that were smart, you know.
Yeah.
So like he says, you know, war is 99% routine that trained monkeys could perform, said Kiefer. But the 1% of chance and creative action on which the history of world is hanging right now, you'll find on carriers. That's what I want to be a part of. So my dear brother, who would like nothing better than to rest his duff in Hawaii for the rest of the war, and then it goes on, his brother was there. And then, let's see, I believe he was talking to him at this point, too, and Kiefer says, I don't mind it when there's only 50% waist motion. Communication is 98% waist motion, you know, so he's, you know, it's almost the same sentence. And then the zinger that who said this?
What is it?
So that's your pons asinorum of shipboard life. The Navy is a master plan designed by geniuses for execution by idiots.
That's Willie, I think, asking him.
Yeah. But did Kiefer say that originally?
Yeah, that's I was
in my head.
Says,
I was,
because
okay, I was in my head. I was attributing that to Kiefer.
Oh no, because he points out that because Kiefer's basically saying. In fact, I talked to my husband about this after I read it, and I said he's almost complaining, or he's telling Willie, "Don't waste your time trying to think. This has been figured out for the lowest possible common denominator."
That's right, and I've heard military guys tell me that.
Well, how could it not be?
In modern people.
Well, how could it not be, though? I mean, you've got all these different people from all these backgrounds, and you only have time for so much training. It's like any big automated factory, in a sense. I mean, you have to have a certain amount of room for thinking. That's why, you know, in fact, kind of an interesting example that pops to mind is Stillwell, who's the... Yeah. I can't remember his title, but he steers the ship. And, you know, he's kind of like a natural genius at it. And they all acknowledge it, except for Captain Queeg, who only knows how to go by the book. And he's like the lowest common denominator of captain because he's so worried about going by the book and these lowest common denominators, like, are your shirt tails tucked in? So that after he's told somebody to go, you know, told Stillwell hard right, he's yelled at Stillwell so much, Stillwell's terrified to disobey. But they cut their tow line.
Yeah.
So it's that, I don't know, it's that kind of example of those are the people they were making it for. And think about the fact that this whole idea of, well, I don't want to deal with the problem. You know, after a couple of mistakes, Queeg gets called in and they're like, look, you've never really done this before. I think I could... you know, rig your fitness reports so that, you know, you still look good, but you can go home, you can be with your wife, you'll have plenty to do anyway. And he's like, oh no, that looked terrible on my record. And so he's, the admiral's like, oh, I wanted to see that report before you sent it in to the guy who'd been talking to the captain, examining him essentially. And so they talk about it and go, yeah, he's probably, you get the feeling they don't say it, but they're kind of like, oh, he's probably not really great. And they're like, yeah, I don't want to deal with it. Assign them over here. Let them deal with it. And that's also kind of the lowest common denominator thinking.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's fascinating. Yeah. And in this crucible or whatever, which I guess is really heightened by being at war, is this life-altering experience. You know, it's like you're working inside this system. You're a cog in a system, and you're nothing more than a cog. It's almost as if doing things out of the ordinary get frowned upon. It's like you're embarrassing other people.
Well,
you know, if you go above and beyond.
Well, also though, your kind of idea about your question about, you know, his going back and forth with May versus having been in the machine of the Navy. Mm-hmm. I think one of the points that gets made is what the Navy has taught him is discipline. You don't have to have discipline doing something you love. You have to have discipline just to get through stuff. Like, I was just listening to a history of...
That's the key thing right there.
Yeah,
that's
Teddy Roosevelt and how he got through his asthma because his father said, you need a strong body, so he'd exercise like crazy. Well, he had to have intense discipline to do that, plus everything else he did. And that was something that he made him able to take his natural abilities and use them to the utmost.
Yeah. That's what I was missing right there. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That is the key to it all.
Yeah, I hadn't really actually thought about it, so I'm glad you brought it up. Mm-hmm. Because I was going, wait, there was another factor. Because, yeah, he's still emotionally, he has to sort out what's going on. And he does by the end of the book. But as a person, I mean, just as he's learned discipline, you know.
Yeah. Love it. Cool.
Yeah. And that's something we all have to work on, too.
Yeah,
I agree. Whether it's comfortable life or not.
And then, Captain Queeg went off the rails, right?
Right.
Okay, so, yeah, if we
he
back up real quick.
Yeah,
if we back up real quick and talk about Captain DeVry. Now, Captain DeVry appears to be undisciplined, which I think is the way that Willie Keith sees him, right? But he puts some discipline on Willie Keith, even though... I think that Willie Keith is still thinking, well, this guy is slovenly, he's undisciplined, and he's giving me these things to do that I can't see the point of.
Yeah.
And then through that discipline stuff, he has that event that you talked about where he was very interested in what was going on in the ship, and he was watching, I think, the retrieval mm-hmm. of a boy or something like that. And this I don't know what you call a
urgent dispatch, I think.
Yeah, an urgent dispatch comes in, you know, held by a sailor, and the sailor gives him this thing and says, "Hey, you need to. This is an action dispatch, and you need to decode it right away because it's probably orders for the ship or whatever." And he puts it, Willie puts it in his pocket, and continues to watch what's happening, thinking, you know, okay, I'll get to it in a second. And then he ends up getting doused with water, and he just gets involved with what's going on and completely forgets about the dispatch. And then DeVry ends up kind of slamming him for that, because 3 days later he says, you know, Keith, to the captain's quarters or whatever. But they got the dispatch again, or they figured out that there was something missing, and they retrieved it and somebody else decoded it. And it ended up being orders for DeVry to be replaced. But, you know, that was a serious – that was – you know, that could have been something like, we need this ship in this position at this time.
Right.
Or people are going to die.
Right.
And DeVry let him have it. He let him know that that was not acceptable. And he even did some things in this report that made him look not stellar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it said something about, you know, he would be a good officer if he pays attention or something like that, or takes things more seriously.
Yeah.
And he's getting this from the captain that he feels is slovenly. But it's not until Queeg comes around that he can see DeVry's value. Right?
Yeah. Because it was interesting when Queeg comes aboard, DeVry several times was like, well, so do you want to take her out and I'll let you practice running her around out in the ocean? Do you want to, we have several days, I'll you know, take you over the ship and have you do, and he's like, no. Queeg's like, well, I'm fine.
Mm-hmm. I'm fine, yeah.
And, you know, we very quickly see he doesn't really know what he's doing. And so as the book goes on, when I think back on that incident, you realize that he was proud. He didn't want anyone to think he didn't know what he was doing. And he was afraid mm-hmm. because he didn't want anyone to he didn't know what he was doing without realizing that everybody's afraid some, and not everybody has all this experience. And of course, of all the people who would have been understanding, it would have been DeVry, who was very understanding, a good captain and very understanding of things. And, I'm like, how many times do we shoot ourselves in the foot that way?
Yeah, no question.
Because we just don't want to look bad.
Right, right. And, you know, Willie, I still feel like DeVry was a very valuable guy. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? He knew what he was doing.
He understood the
Willie
ship.
Willie Keith, yeah, he understood the ship. He understood the guys.
Yeah.
And Willie didn't see that, right? And this was part of his maturing process. And then when Queeg came in, just like you're saying, Queeg is, you know, paranoid. He's afraid, you know, and I think that, you know, his actions are, he is horrified at being overruled or disrespected. And these are all just insecurity things, right? He wants to be respected. He wants his orders to be followed. And these are the important things to him because he doesn't really understand. He doesn't really know what he's doing, and he doesn't want people to know. And he managed to get all the way to there in the U.S. Navy.
Yeah.
You know, with that being the truth. And that's an interesting thing, too.
Probably happens a lot.
Yeah.
I don't mean necessarily in the Navy. I just mean...
Yeah.
You know,
I know what happens in business.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. You can bluff your way so far, and then
You know, how many times you heard, you know, that someone gets promoted beyond their ability?
Yeah,
it's like, you know, they move them one step too far,
mm-hmm.
and now, you know, the person is in a position of incompetence. It's like out of their league, out of what they're capable of. Their gifts are no longer useful in this other new level.
Right.
And, you know, that happens a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Kui could,
yeah, I guess Kui could be that. Yeah.
Well, and in one sense he is, but in the other sense, what we see is a complete lack of discipline personally, because he's in the famous strawberries incident, which we can talk about in more depth. But I mean, he's had what you said, 4 helpings of strawberries and ice cream, 4 helpings. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And he took all the officers' liquor rations. He politely made them give them his liquor rations, and then he was going to try and sell them for himself to make the money. I mean, he was also greedy and a small thinker, and it's just a lack of discipline. It's a lack of understanding the big picture.
So. Right, and he couldn't see, I don't know how a person doesn't see this, but he couldn't see that blaming mistakes on other people makes you lose the people.
Yeah, and that's something I wanted to mention, in the sense that he thinks nobody's going to catch him, first of all. You know, like when he almost grounds the ship, or he does ground the ship, I guess, and they have to get pulled out by the tug, and everybody's saying, well, okay, so we have to fill out the accident log or whatever. And he's like, oh, no need to do that. That's, you know, just pencil that in. Not a big deal. We'll erase it later. And it happens all the time. And so when there are people, when there are instances where there's only one person who he thinks really can pin him down on something going wrong, like Stillwell and cutting the tow line, or when Willie knows about the message about Rabbit's promotion, that he says, well, just hold on to that. And then the guy's captain comes over and goes, I need him, or whoever it was. It might have been an admiral, but I think it was a captain. Anyway, Willie's the only one who sees that, and then he turns against Willie. He's turning all the blame on other people, and it made me think about we all have that tendency to do that. We like to think we're better than we are, and we don't like it when other people catch us doing something wrong. And I was thinking, since we are talking about this as Catholics, I was like, you know, that makes me even more grateful for the sacrament of confession, because it makes me have to regularly go through self-examination. I have to say, what's getting in the way? What am I doing wrong? How can I make it right? Because, you know, God's already seen me do it. I have to admit it to myself and then admit it to him. You know, and this is this kind of epitomizes how bad it can be when you won't let yourself do it. And everybody around you can see it. And that's the case in our own lives. Everybody knows if I have a bad temper. If I had a bad temper, yeah.
Yeah, so true. So very true. Yeah, you know, it's like he's hiding things that everyone can see.
Yeah.
He's horrified that people will learn things that everybody already knows.
Yeah. But yet he doesn't know what that it's because he doesn't know, I guess, that everybody knows it. Like during the mutiny trial, when he finds out that everybody, his nickname was Old Yellow Stain. And you can see, I started feeling sorry for him. Then he kind of, his head goes down. He's like, they called me that? What? You know?
That's tough when you find out that people look at you differently than you think they look at you.
That was the other thing, is how do people see you? Because, you know, Kiefer turns into Captain Queeg, essentially.
That's interesting. When he's, I can see what you're saying.
Yeah, after the mutiny.
Right, that's very interesting.
Yeah. And he was the guy who thought he had everyone fooled. He had, you know, the quips, and he was intelligent, and he'd figured all this stuff out, and he's a known novelist, or he's becoming a known novelist. Mm-hmm. And then what everybody sees him do that he wants to ignore is, you know, he totally bails on Merrick. Is that how you say his name?
Yeah,
Merrick.
Merrick.
When he's on trial, he totally bails on him. When Merrick wants to go over and complain to somebody else to see if they can get help with Captain Queeg, he totally pulls him out of it and bails on him there. Then later on, of course, he jumps overboard and makes like 2/3 of the ship jump with him. The only difference is he can admit it after that.
Wow. Yeah.
So you feel like there might be...
Yeah, I see exactly what you're saying. I think that that's something. That's something else. Yeah, and Kiefer is the... you know, he's a smart guy in the system. He doesn't, he thinks he's kind of above it and doesn't really want to be part of it. And he talks throughout the whole novel. He's talking negatively about Queeg and how, you know, he needs to be, you know, gotten rid of and all this stuff. And then that thing with his brother happened, and that, that was rough. You know, which makes what he did during the court-martial even more flabbergasting.
Oh, yeah.
Because, yeah, he lost his brother. What happened, his brother was serving on the Kane for a while, and then his brother was transferred to another ship that went into battle. But before it went into battle, they had a day in which he could have gone over there to visit him, but Queeg didn't let him because some of his paperwork wasn't done.
Right.
So then what happened is the ship took off and went to war, and his brother died during that.
Yeah, and his brother...
He blamed Queeg for missing that last meeting.
Well, and but here's the thing, too, that's so different. Mm-hmm. His brother was... Wasn't he down in the engine room, and he kept everything going, and he saved the ship?
Yeah,
essentially.
He was a hero.
And yeah, he was a hero. And his brother knew that, or Kiefer knew that. But when they're in a very similar situation, it's, you know, the kamikaze pilot has hit them, but not straight on, so maybe they can save it. And everybody who's in position has been doing things. Willie's been calling out orders, and they've been kind of doing the best they can. And Gaffer's like, that's it. We're all going to die. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
But so he had his brother's example in front of him. You don't know, is he panicked because of that? He never says he was when he's talking about it later. He was just terrified.
Right.
But he prided himself as being above everyone. He incited the mutiny, essentially.
He really did, yeah.
By putting all these ideas
in
everybody's
head.
In fact,
you know, early on, you know, he was to that executive officer Merrick. He was saying, you know, what about mental illness? You know, this guy is sick.
Right.
Haven't you, you know, read about this? And Merrick at that point was like, I'm not talking to you about this anymore. And if you bring it up again, you know, I'm going to report you.
Yeah.
And but that had set Merrick on that path where he. He started to log all the erratic behavior.
Well, yeah, and everybody else started thinking about it more.
They did.
Because he brought it up. And is he the one who brought up, was Queeg always on the side of the ship that was away from where people were shooting at it?
Yeah.
I think he's the one who said, oh, did you notice? He's never...
I think you're right.
Yeah, and so everybody took him... For one thing, you plant that seed...
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the danger of gossip. Yes.
Ah, I see where you're
Captain
at.
Captain Queeg did all those things. He wasn't the greatest guy. But it didn't have to be the way it was. You know,
and
they
part of the reason it was the way it was because of the way everybody looked at it.
Right. Because, you know, he was small-minded and little and pretty despicable as a person. But you know what? We all work with people like that. But when everybody's ganging up on him and talking about him and bullying him, then you get this sense of entitlement and nothing they do is right anymore.
Mm.
And I don't know. And yeah, he was super unreasonable, but he didn't have a clue and he wasn't going to take a clue from anyone. And frankly, I have a question for you later about the whole court-martial situation. But the thing is the danger of gossip doesn't depend on was the person worthy of gossiping about. None of us are perfect. The danger of gossip is, are you the one sticking the knife in? That's why when you're going over the Ten Commandments, thinking about confession, and it's thou shalt not kill, well, very few of us have actually killed anyone, luckily. But one of the questions that always gets asked is, have you gossiped about somebody or contributed to it or allowed it to go on? Because in a sense, that's murdering that person in that way. You're taking part of their personality away from them by attacking them.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking at it a little bit differently now.
Yeah. And I think that's what Jeff Miller was talking about when he was...
Yeah, he said something about, you said, contributing to the situation.
Yeah. And it's,
well, yeah, and I've been that way in business too, you know.
Yeah. It used to be a terrible problem for me. Gossip. I loved nothing more than passing on the juicy, juicy stuff. And I just happened to be extremely lucky, well, blessed, you would say, that I went on a retreat that was very powerful in a lot of ways, but I came out of it, through the grace of God, with an absolute distaste for gossip.
Mm.
And I can't remember. I realized it when somebody, a neighbor, was standing at my front door one time, and she was trying to talk about somebody who lived between us on the block. And I suddenly realized, I was like, ugh. And I was like, wow, that's different. Before, I would have had my own stories, and I would have just helped it go on.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real natural thing, because it makes you feel so much better than the other person.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Right. Yeah, it makes you wonder, you know, in a business environment, you know, how much do you know that is not really true?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how much needs to be said about somebody?
Right, right.
You know, I mean, the little steel balls, those were a real giveaway that Quig would roll in his fingers, you know. Everybody's looking at that. But a lot of the other stuff, nobody needed to be talking about it and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
Though I still think okay. So my question was.
Okay, yeah, what's your question?
Okay. Seemed to me, but at the end of the book, you know, the defense lawyer for Merrick is defending Captain Quig. And people are kind of going, well, Quig, he didn't need to be court-martialed. And at the very end, the Navy sends in the thing going, you know, we've looked into this. And yes, it was wrong. You, Willie mm-hmm. Keith, will never be in the Navy, you know, as anybody important. And I'm thinking, mm-hmm. so the verdict that came down was he shouldn't have had command taken away from him. And I absolutely do not agree with that.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like that. But so was Merrick wrong? Do you think that was right?
Do I think Merrick was wrong? I think Merrick was right, because I felt like they were in danger at that point.
Yeah, I feel like
the I think that the people on the bridge thought that his decisions were going to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do at that point?
Well, and it's interesting, because now that you say that, I remember there was a sentence about once Merrick was doing it, Willie felt much more relaxed. Because he trusted Merrick.
Right, right. And they didn't trust Captain Quig because of past behavior.
Yeah.
And current behavior, you know, because he was like, the crux was that Merrick said, go to this heading.
Right.
And Captain overruled him, saying, no, the most important thing for us is to follow the orders and go to follow the fleet at this heading. And they're like, if we follow that heading, we're going to die.
Yeah.
You know? So Merrick said, no, we're going to ride the storm out at this heading so we survive by aligning the ship up with the waves and stuff. Then we'll join the fleet after that.
Yeah.
Which is the logical, correct decision.
Yeah. You would certainly think so, because they said three ships went down.
Yeah.
And they saw a ship go down next to them.
After the mutiny happened, it wasn't long after that they came upon a ship that was flipped over.
Okay, that was it.
Yeah, and then they take a lap around it, you know, looking for survivors, and they found some. But yeah, it was crazy. So I think he was right. But then you're like, okay, well, the Navy was, you know, a system, right?
Yeah.
It's a system built by geniuses so idiots can run it, right? Well, how can they be okay with a mutiny?
Well, that's
you know,
a good
it's
point.
Like our system put the captain on the top, right? Or it put the captain in the position he was in. And it's like, so I can see their point saying, you know, you're not going to be anything in the Navy. You know, I'm glad he didn't have to go to jail or anything like that. But I can understand them saying, you don't fit in the system.
Yeah, and I guess that's it, the difference between the system, and because he kept going, you weren't there. If you were there, you would have seen what it, you know, when you take anything apart the way they were doing, going, mm-hmm. you're kidding me. You were upset because of some strawberries? Wait, I don't understand what you're talking about. You were upset because of he made you tuck your shirt tails in like you should? Well, you had to be yeah. there.
There was one,
oh
one line in there. I don't know if I'm going to find it right away, but it was like after Commander Queeg had completed the shirt tail catastrophe or something. I mean, I can't even remember how it was actually put, but it made me laugh out loud. It's like focusing on the wrong things, you know, while the ship is going around in a circle.
Maybe that's yeah. part of Cap. Maybe Queeg not encapsulates is the main example of the problem with the Navy and doing things like applying the mutiny law. Now we're going to hear from all these people who are in the Navy, or you know, like mm-hmm. Jeff Miller and
yeah,
everybody.
You're
going, you guys are so totally wrong. But I'm just saying, from the outside, that was, you know, I mean, you feel like the people who gave the ruling, seeing Queeg come apart the way they did and hearing what uh-huh. him ramble on about everything, that's when they went, oh, so when the Navy's countermanding them, they're going, well, you had to be there.
You had to be there. That's too funny. That's probably the defense for almost every infraction ever committed.
Probably so. You had to be
there. You had to be there.
You really had yeah. to be there.
Yeah. Now, there was an interesting line here. Trying to figure out who is talking here. Dun, dun, dun. Let's see. Merrick. Okay, so Merrick says, okay, this is about on page 310. So, you know, mutiny hasn't happened or anything like that. But he says, I'm going to be walking in on admirals. This is Merrick talking to Kiefer.
Oh, yeah.
And they'll be calling on doctors, and I just can't present the thing myself. Anyway, I'm no writer. You think the log is enough, and the log is what he was keeping track of the incidents.
Right.
A hell of a lot is in the way a thing is written up for an outsider. You know all these things happen, but when someone reads them cold, I've got to have you along, Tom. There was a long silence. The son of a bitch kept me from seeing my brother, Kiefer said unsteadily. His eyes glared. And then here's the thing. Merrick says, that's beside the point, Tom. If the old man's sick in the head, there's nothing to be sore about.
Yeah. It was all personal.
That was an interesting line.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I totally missed that. That's what a great point.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, so Merrick didn't feel angry, right?
Right, and he was continually the one who would say, I'm not listening to any of this, and he'd leave mm-hmm. when they were bad-mouthing the captain. Or he'd tell
right.
him, he's like, he was, you guys need to shut up. And they wouldn't, so he'd leave.
Yeah.
Man, he was exemplary in all those ways, wasn't he?
I think that he was, yeah, and it's interesting, you know, when we talk about, you know, people under pressure and how they react and stuff, that was his reaction.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, yeah, Kiefer didn't come through very
no,
well.
He was, well, and the other thing was, is that kind of also explains the way Merrick was when, after Kiefer kind of bailed on him and got, oh, well, it wasn't as bad as all that when he's testifying for the mutiny, so he just, you know, hangs Merrick out to dry. And Merrick's like, I should have seen that one coming. And afterward, Merrick gets off, and there's a big party because Kiefer has sold his novel, and there's a big cake, and they're throwing the party, and they're toasting Merrick and everything. And Merrick doesn't say one word to him about it.
Mm-hmm.
He's just like, oh, okay. And it's not that he's not feeling it and knowing what happened, and doesn't it take the lawyer, I think, to give it away, but he's just not gonna let that get in the way of anything. He's just gonna move on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a really admirable trait, and I wish I could do that better. That's, you know,
yeah,
forgiveness is one of those things where you just, or you know, even if you just kind of go, wow, I hate this, but I can't worry about it, moving on.
Right, right. Wow.
Yeah. One of the things I found about this book that I really liked, or are you done with that? I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
This is kind of really switching topics, but I remember that when I was kind of looking through some of the reviews on Amazon or somewhere, maybe Goodreads, and people were saying, well, it's an anti-war book. And I thought, as I was reading, I thought, I don't know if it's an anti-war book or an anti-military book. I felt like...
I don't know that it's either. I honestly don't know if it's either. I'm thinking about that, and I don't recall any conversations about whether they should be fighting or not.
Well, there was one thing. You get the very poignant scenes where Willie is, it's a big growing up moment for one thing, when they're all eating ice cream and the battle's happening nearby, but they're so far out, and he suddenly realizes that, because he's thinking of it all abstractly, he's not thinking about the 1,000 Japanese men who are being, you know, shelled to death. He's just, oh, look at that. That's beautiful. He's eating ice cream later, and he's thinking, wait, those guns I'm hearing, they're killing people. And our guys are dying, too. And we're sitting here eating ice cream. Isn't there something weird about that?
Yeah, and he mentioned it to the other guys.
Yeah, he brings it up, and only the newest guy goes, oh, I'm not so hungry. Everybody else is like, whoa, whatever. Mm-hmm. So there's those moments that kind of just point out the odd situation she must be in a lot. But I loved it when he's flying home and he's on the plane and it says, but the plane flew over the spiky buildings of Manhattan in a violet and pearl dawn, and Willie woke and his heart revived as he peered through the little round window. New York was the most beautiful place on earth. It was more than that. It was the Garden of Eden. It was the lost island of sweet golden springtime. It was the place where he had loved May Wynn. The plane tilted and glided downward. The gold-white sun appeared above the eastern clouds, brightening the air with slant rays. As the plane wheeled, Willie saw Manhattan again, the Empire State Building, the Chrysler Building, Radio City, their lean shafts suddenly rosy above the purple haze which still veiled the city. There came into his mind's eye the beach of Kwajalein, the wide blue vacancy of the South Pacific, the orange puffs of shore batteries on the green hills of Saipan, and the pitching drenched wheelhouse of the cane and the shrieking typhoon. In that instant, Willie understood the war.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And I looked at that, and I think it's Tolkien who said, we don't fight because we hate what's in front of us. We fight because we love what's behind us.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so it's not, I mean, some battles are worth fighting.
Well, some things you have to fight. I mean, look at ISIS, you know. You've got to stop that. You can't let that oppression go on like that. That's just not right.
Sure.
And that's the kind of, you know, people talk about just war theory, and it gets applied to a lot of stuff, and that's where St. Augustine, just Bishop Augustine back in the day, said, you know, there it's okay sometimes to fight, but that's what he was talking about. And it gets twisted around where people go, well, we should be able to fight for this and this. But somebody was saying, I think it was actually, I was listening to that Catholic history from the great teaching courses or whatever it's called, the great courses that you gave me. And the guy was saying, if you go back and read what he said, it's really narrow. It's to save lives and protect innocent people.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. Interesting.
Well, he also, you know, Herman, is it Wook, he said?
Woke is what I'd say, but who knows? Yeah.
Wook makes me think of a Wookiee, so woke is probably better.
Mm-hmm.
But he could write some of those scenes so wonderfully, like the thing when they're at Okinawa and they get the news that the war is over. Did that impress you at all? I mean, suddenly Willie Keith hears the news and he's like, I made it. I came out alive.
Yeah, there's right.
No sound. Mm-hmm. So he's thinking, well, I guess.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, why weren't they all jumping up and down upstairs?
Right. And then it says a military band blared from the radio when Johnny comes marching home. A single green star shell suddenly burst over Okinawa and floated slowly down near the moon. Then all at once, an unbelievably brilliant cascade of lights and fireworks began rising from the island. A million crimson streams of tracers, countless blue and white searchlights fanning frantically back and forth, red flares, green flares, white flares, star shells, a 4th of July display many miles long of ammunition suddenly sprayed to the starry black heavens in a thank prayer for peace. And he keeps going because they're shooting their guns and they're...
Wow.
I won't read the whole thing, but it says, at the end, it says, "For an instant, Willie was marching up Fifth Avenue in the sunshine in an immense parade of the Navy, and crowds on the sidewalk were screaming cheers, and ticker tape was falling on his face as he marched. He saw the towers of Radio City and the spire of St. Patrick's. His hair prickled on his skull, and he thanked God for having sent him to the Cane to fight in the war."
Wow.
Yeah.
See, that's something else.
Yeah, he really could. Yeah. He could write these scenes. Oh, he wrote the whole book is wonderful, but yeah, it's
very well written. I mean, yeah, really flowed so well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I never had a problem getting into it at any time.
No, and he conveyed emotion and tone so well. When you were with May and Willie in those little places they sang, or you know, little diners where they ate, you could feel that atmosphere. Mm-hmm. I could, anyway. You're really transferred to the place.
Yeah. Yep. And I was. I was there the whole time. Mm-hmm. You know, every bit of this book, I was right there.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Really a great book.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, no.
I'm really glad you liked it. This one I picked, and I was like, well, I hope so. You know, I really like it, so let's see what happens. But good.
A lot of our stuff. A lot of our stuff lately. We've been doing that more and more because we're so far into this now that we've got to talk about these themes books mm-hmm. down, and now we're just going, I like this one, and there's so much stuff in there that you.
Yeah, and it was surprising to reread it, you know, and then you know to find this stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating. I love it.
But that's the thing about good stories are resonating with those basic themes of life.
Yeah.
That's what makes us thrilled to them. We feel it deep down. We understand it.
Yeah. Yeah, well put.
Oh, thank you.
Way to go.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on the book?
Yeah, and that's all I had.
You did it. All right. No, I thought I'm glad.
How about you?
No, I've got nothing. I thought it was, I enjoyed it a lot mm-hmm. the second time even. So what about, let's see, Herman Wouk, his other famous book, I don't know if you've read it, Winds of War.
Oh, no.
And War and Remembrance. I know they're big, giant books.
Yep, and I've heard
so I'm going to select them both for the next note.
I'm sorry.
I kid.
Uncle Tom's Cabin.
That's right, and I have it right here.
Just plenty big.
I have the copy of the book right here. So that's next for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is going to be in 4 weeks from now. But yes. In 2 weeks from now, there's a movie.
Johnny's not marching home yet. We got the Dirty Dozen.
That's right. That's right. I can't wait. That's going to be fun.
Yeah.
And then after that is Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Yeah.
And then after that, I better get some selecting in.
Yeah.
So
that's kind of the fun part.
It is. So the
things.
Right. So the next podcast, I will have that selected.
Oh, promises.
Very cool. No, really. I swear.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Oh, too good.
Oh, well,
good.
If they keep going as good as this one, so bring them on.
Yeah. Well, good.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for the kind comments on the blog lately and emails that we've been getting. It's nice to hear from people.
Yeah, the iTunes ratings.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Thank you very much for all that.
It's nice to hear that people are enjoying listening, at least partly as much as we're enjoying talking.
You bet. All right. Well, take care, everybody.
Yes.
See you next time.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you.